Well, American politics is never shy of drama, but 2024 saw one of the most dramatic and chaotic presidential elections in modern history. President Joe Biden dropped out of the race after a catastrophic debate. Kamala Harris had the shortest presidential campaign in history, and Donald Trump survived two assassination attempts and won his way back to the White House. America and the world are now gearing up for round two of Donald Trump in the White House. To talk about all of this and what's to come, we're now joined by Scott Jennings, Republican strategist who worked for George W. Bush's administration, Hank Scheinkopf, a political consultant who was an advisor to Bill Clinton, and Nadia Brown, political scientist at Georgetown University. Thanks all for joining us.
Thank you. Pleasure. Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
Scott, can I start with you first? Donald Trump, he has been labelled the comeback kid. And I spoke to you back in 2022 after the midterm elections for our year in review back then. And you told me then that it looked like Donald Trump was losing altitude among Republican voters and a governor would likely take the Republican nomination. And that was a strong feeling in the Republican Party. What made all of that change?
Yeah, absolutely. Boy, was I wrong. I mean, at the time in 2022, following the midterms, you know, Republicans were not happy that they had not done as well as they thought they should have done. And there was some belief that Trump and the candidates that he had helped arrange were a big reason for it. But he launched his presidential campaign. And what happened after that was quite remarkable. Democrats and prosecutors and, you know, sort of his political opponents launched this lawfare campaign against him. It started with the raid in Mar-a-Lago over the documents case and went on into New York, where he was indicted on the paperwork, sex paperwork case, as I call it. And that whole maneuver, that set of maneuvers against Trump, sort of re-galvanized the Republican Party behind him. And from that point forward, he was strong as new rope, as we say in Kentucky, and he never looked back. He was never seriously challenged in the Republican primary. And as you pointed out, he has completed what is the most remarkable comeback in American political history.
Scott, during that conversation, you also said that the Democrats will nominate Joe Biden as their presidential nominee, but they would be crazy to do so. So part of your crystal ball was accurate there, I have to say. Nadia, would you agree with Scott's assessment there about Donald Trump and his way back becoming that comeback kid?
Yeah, I will agree. I believe that there was just so many people, particularly Republicans, who had shown a pretty strong force against Trumpism as moving away from traditional conservative or neoliberal values, that Trump was going to have a really tough road to hoe, particularly after January 6th. But that didn't happen. And so instead, what we saw was that there was a real chokehold by Trump and his allies on the Republican Party. But then, right, we have to also juxtapose this to what was happening in the nation and around the world. So we know that Western democracies, all Western democracies that had elections post-COVID have voted out the incumbent, and they have moved further to the right, some countries like Italy electing more authoritarian regimes. We see this Germany's government has just collapsed. We see this happening in Poland. And so it's not just about Trump, but also like just taking a look at what's happening in other Western democracies, that the incumbents and the more liberal parties were having a very tough time holding on to power.
Because Nadia, you were at Howard University on election night when Kamala Harris supporters gathered at her alma mater. Can you bring us back to that night? What was it like?
Also, I am also an alumna of Howard University, so it was a really special moment for graduates of Howard, for graduates of other historically Black colleges and universities, as well as other members of the Divine Nine, which are nine historically Black fraternities and sororities. And that moment just felt really magical to see that our community, our culture was being recognized at such a large national scale. And in terms of that night, it was pretty, again, pretty magical. magical. There was a DJ. There are lots of people walking around, hugging. It kind of felt, one of my friends that went to Spelman College that attended the event with me said, is this what a Howard University homecoming feels like? And in some, it felt like a family reunion. That aura, of course, changed as the night went on. Mm. And closer to 11 o'clock, 11:30, it was pretty clear that Kamala Harris did not have a path towards victory. And at that moment, it started to feel a bit somber, but it felt somber in a communal way, right? Where people were there that were disappointed in the election outcomes as we thought it was going to turn out, which it ultimately did, but had someone to talk about it in real time, as opposed to watching the election results at home by yourself, in your home by yourself.
Hank, can I come to you? At what point did you know the writing was on the wall for the Democrats?
The day that Joe Biden fell apart at the debate. Mm. I think people are missing the point. The Democratic Party in the United States is in very serious trouble and has been for quite some time. It is no longer a party, but a group of factions that they have a particular agenda within them. And they join together only in national elections. It's the disintegration of that party is, you could make the argument, you know, that it is part of an international phenomena. But I would really say that it's really about an American phenomena. That Americans are changing, their value structure changing. The country's demographics are changing rapidly. This is no longer a European-based country. More than 50% of the people who are here now cannot trace their roots to Europe. So the changing of the culture, the sense that things are out of control, mandated, frankly, that Trump would win. And Harris ran one of the, you know, somebody who's worked on hundreds of campaigns over the last 40 years. I'm certainly an expert. It was among the worst campaigns I've ever seen. They didn't understand message. The Democrats don't have a clue what they stand for. Their ads were terrible. The thinking behind them was awful. And the business under the Democrats is deteriorating into a kind of what I call the political industrial complex. It's everything you don't want to have in the political business. And the Republicans are just better at it right now. And that's going to continue for a while because the Democrats are too wed to old style of thinking and old style of doing things.
Scott, what do you make of that?
Well, I agree with a lot of what Hank said, actually. And, you know, the Harris campaign, I think, ran effectively on the belief that it would just be enough not to be Donald Trump. And it turned out that's not enough. And it just didn't work. And people needed more. And I think when you're coming out of a 4-year period where inflation was really high, people were upset about it, as Hank said, where people were sort of, I think, mistrustful of what was going on around them, mistrustful of their government, you know, wondering out of the COVID period how much truth was withheld from us at the time. I mean, there was a whole sort of cascading set of issues that I think led to people believing, you know, 3/4 of the American people thought the country was off on the wrong track. So if you were Harris, you know, what are your choices? And she made the worst one, which was to say, I can't really think of anything on which I would change or differ from Joe Biden. That was not a tenable position. So she made Trump's job in some ways extremely easy. And of course, he is really good at finding, you know, the little things. He's like a perfect mirror, and he's a genius empath, you know, when it comes to detecting the emotional moods of the American people. And he found the issues that mattered, inflation and immigration. He had an opponent who had no idea how to message on them. And that's why he did the most remarkable thing, which a lot of folks didn't think was possible, not just win the Electoral College, but win the national popular vote and help sweep his party into majorities in Congress. I mean, there were a lot of people who thought he could win, but he'd never be able to win the popular vote. And to do that really has led us to have this discussion about whether he has a mandate to govern and do things, you know, beyond what you know, Democrats would want him to do. And I think he does have a mandate, truthfully. I think people want change. They decided he was the change candidate, and now he better deliver change. That's the mandate.
But Scott, even if we look at Donald Trump and how Congress is read at the moment, it doesn't seem that Donald Trump does have that mandate or power, complete power over the Republican Party. I mean, all we have to do is look recently over the huge debate that we're having over government funding and the Republican not following Donald Trump's line.
Well, these are, I think, momentary undulations and procedure. But make no mistake, Donald Trump is the unquestioned head of and influencer of the Republican Party. If he wants something to happen in the Republican Party, there is a high, high likelihood that it will happen. Look what happened during the election. There was a massive amount of effort, money, a whole campaign put behind the so-called Never Trump movement. People who were, you know, trying to get the so-called Nikki Haley Republicans. And they had Liz Cheney, daughter of Dick Cheney, former vice president, out campaigning the principal surrogate for Kamala Harris. And none of it worked. No Republicans really defected to Harris. Look at the splits in the exit polling. Trump dominates his political party, dominated in the election, and dominates it right now. So, you know, I wouldn't overread the momentary, you know, tactical or procedural undulations in Congress. Trump's the head of the party. His line of thinking about our culture, his line of thinking about, you know, what political party should stand for, his attitude, his overall demeanor, that is the dominant attitude and force in this, in today's Republican Party.
But just to press you a little bit more on that, Scott, if we look at Rick Scott, who was Donald Trump's favorite to become Senate Majority Leader, that didn't happen either. We saw John Thune take that role, and he has a rocky relationship with Trump. And some of Donald Trump's picks for his cabinet, for his administration, they're up in the air at the moment too. It's not entirely sure whether they will even be confirmed by the Senate.
Well, Trump didn't endorse in the Senate Majority Leader's race. That's number one. Some of his allies, like Rick Scott, that's true. But and I wouldn't overread the so-called rocky relationship between Thune and Trump. On his nominees, well, they're all up in the air because none of them have been voted on yet. He doesn't take office until January 20th. And I think some of the nominees are more controversial than others, but all have a chance to be confirmed. And most of his picks, I would point out, are, I think, people that any Republican president would have chosen, not just Donald Trump. So I think it's easy in any given moment to try to trick yourself or to tell yourself a story about how Donald Trump is not as strong as he is. But I'll just tell you this. Joe Biden ran 4 years ago to rid the country of Trumpism and to heal the soul of the nation. And he's leaving office with a divided country, more divided than ever. And Donald Trump in the strongest political position of his life. This was a failed project. Trump is back. He's stronger than ever, and he has more control of his party than he has ever had today.
Well, Nadia, you know, Donald Trump's elections, they make clear that he plans a radical shakeup of government. You know, we don't have conventional or even experienced picks. What do you make of that, Nadia?
Oh, I think that is what voters get when they voted for Trump, right? This is not a surprise. The people that he nominated for the first time around, some were also pretty outside of mainstream America, and others were hardline right-wingers. And so I think what we're seeing this time is what we had anticipated, particularly because there have been so many tell-alls from former cabinet members who have written books in the past 4 years when he was out of power. So it's not a surprise. The part that I think is most alarming is the shift to having more billionaires in the cabinet and those that are out of touch with everyday Americans, just given their own lived experiences and circumstances. Is where they find themselves in. And so it seems to be a bit of a misnomer that Trump and this administration has their eye on the working class when the people that Trump has surrounded themselves with are not of that background and have actively worked to either bust unions or to undercut labor and really out of touch with everyday Americans. Life. And so talking about the inflation and understanding how inflation impacts people day to day by going to the grocery store or making choices between, you know, paying for medical drug prescriptions or having to reduce where they live to pay less rent isn't something that I think that the people that Trump have picked as part of his cabinet to be really leaders in reducing inflation, particularly as most economists and other political historians note that his policies to try to put America first might actually be more damaging to the American economy.
Yeah, do you think Donald Trump's bark is worse than his bite? You know, when he talks about taxes, when he talks about tariffs, as I said at the beginning, America and the world are gearing up for a second Trump presidency and they are trying to prepare.
Well, I think that Trump will, I mean, of course, he says a lot of things, right? And some of which we need to take literally and others which is just rhetoric. However, I do think that the rhetoric of increasing tariffs and trying to, I think, alienate some of America's chief trading partners are a strong man move in a way to make particularly Canada and Mexico try to kowtow to what Trump would like to happen in terms of immigration. But overall, I don't think that his policies are going to be able to get out of Congress. We know that although Republicans control the 119th Congress, they do so with a slim majority, and they're going to either need to get everyone in their caucus to go along, or they're going to have to get Democrats on board. I think it's going to be a pretty tough sell. So instead, what I think Trump is going to do is continue to use the bully pulpit, being able to, kind of make decrees and make statements that are going to alarm a lot of people, whether that's on X or Trump Social or Truth Social, or, just kind of say these things to media in passing. But I think ultimately what he'll try to do is pass executive orders that will have some difficulty perhaps getting its way through the courts. But I think he'll have a really tough row to hoe in front of him if he's trying to push these kind of legislation through Congress.
So, Hank, strong words from Trump for better deals. What do you think?
Consistent with what we see, Tim Snyder has written about it, these kinds of things. Anne Applebaum has written about these kinds of things. Other scholars have read extensively. When you try to destroy institutions, which is what he's done, the institutions seek to protect themselves and protect the system in which they function, or they collapse. And there are multiple instances of this through history, especially in the last 100 years. And I think Europeans understand that better than anybody. The Senate is not going to collapse for Donald Trump. That thing is not about Republican or Democrat. He's about protecting the Senate, the same way that Mitch McConnell was. Mitch McConnell, went the outgoing leader, went out of his way on some occasions to placate Trump. But this is a real battle about American institutions and American democracy. And it's no different than as our esteemed colleague, great professor, noted. This is a period of transition for democracies throughout the world. Trump is more at home with an Orban or a Putin or others than he is with normative democratic practice. Therefore, destroying institutions is part of that. He's going to take them on, and he's going to fail when it comes to the Senate. The House of Representatives of the United States is an entirely different issue. Why? 2-year terms, more frightened of the power of the president, but the Senate is not. And they will take him on whenever possible. And it doesn't matter how much money somebody comes up on the other side, because they won those races against a well-funded Democratic majority. And they did it well, and they have much more. They've got a great, a larger margin of victory. They've got more seats. And they look like to be able to gain seats in the next cycle. So that's the balance of protecting democracy against the, whether it's Republican or Democrat, the use of executive orders, and other, frankly, non-sanctioned by democratic system kinds of practices. So we have to, there's a lot the world can look forward to. And the world ought to be a little bit frightened too, especially in Europe, when it comes to some of the defense policies, which are more dangerous, in fact, than some of the domestic policies the Democrats are railing about.
Scott, is Trump destroying institutions like Hank says?
Oh, I think, I guess I have more confidence in the American system, the American Constitution, and American institutions than some. I think that, you could make arguments that Democrats have also challenged institutional norms over the last 4 years. I mean, goodness knows Joe Biden pursued executive orders and other policies that were unconstitutional and were ultimately thrown out by the court. I actually think every president, tests the boundaries and see what they can get away with. And the presidency usually gets a little stronger and a little wider every single term. I think Hank made an interesting point on the Senate, and I totally agree with it. It is a different thing than the House. I think Trump will have more control over the House, although you can see there are still some people in the House. There's always been an interesting push and pull in Trump's Republican Party between what he wants to do and the old sort of DNA of the Tea Party movement, which came along in 2010. The old line, fiscal conservative, cut deficits, cut spending. That is at odds sometimes with what Trump wants to do. You're seeing that play out on the government funding battle. But in the Senate, you do have maybe 4 to 7 senators who are sort of unthreatenable. They're not running for reelection. They're at the beginning of a 6-year term. Trump will be gone before they have to run again. There are a couple of them that benefit from having public feuds with Trump because their constituencies back home want them to be more independent-minded. So he is going to have to wrestle a little bit with the Senate, and it won't be like it was before because some of these senators you know, have had falling out with him, like Mitch McConnell, who was mentioned. So it is a different political dynamic. And honestly, how Trump navigates that, how he deals with that, how he, you know, tries to bring some of those people in that are more skeptical of him, that is going to be determinative on how successful he is at passing his legislative agenda. So I think Hank is right. The institution of the Senate is a different thing, and Trump's going to have to find a way around a few of these folks.
Well, Scott, we started with your crystal ball, so let's finish with it. After Donald Trump's inauguration, first week in office, what can you see him doing?
Well, I think he's going to get quick confirmations on most of his cabinet picks. Not all, but most. And number two, I think the most dramatic thing we're going to see right out of the gate will be what he chooses to do via executive order and administrative action on deporting illegal immigrants out of the United States. He has appointed a very aggressive czar for border enforcement, Tom Homan, who is promising deportations begin on day one. So all economic, trade, and foreign policy aside, internally in the United States, we'll see, and I think it's going to be quick, how fast Trump can move on fulfilling the promise for mass deportations of illegal immigrants out of the United States.
Hank, the future for the Democrats in 2025?
Bleak. Unless they can figure out how to make that this fractious non-party, which is just a group of you know, kind of factions, function collectively. They also don't understand, they don't understand crime, they don't understand disorder. They don't understand message. They don't understand the emotional nature of campaigns anymore. And they really just don't understand the value arguments. Trump was elected because people felt economic pressure, but they also felt the combination of disorder as part of that economic pressure, which is kind of what elected Bill Clinton in 1992, sense of things being out of control. And they also were beyond themselves with value arguments. They don't want to be told about transgender issues anymore when they're having trouble making the rent. They don't want to be told about any of these things. They see the government's job is very different. Trump will conform to that. That will help him, but he'll be an angry man in about 6 months. Very angry, and who knows what he'll do then.
Nadia, are you going to end on a more positive note?
I think as a political scientist, that's hard for me to do. I think that both political parties in the United States are in peril. I think while my colleague mentioned some reasons why he believes the Democrats will have a tough time in 2025, I think the same is true for Republicans who don't necessarily have a core set of policy values, but rather have a set of emotions and follow blind allegiance to someone who doesn't put much respect into American institutions. And so rather, I think research shows us that this is a time of transition and that Americans as people should think about the agency that they have and not be beholden to political parties. We saw this happen, which is the second time that a non-incumbent president was able to get a second term in office under Grover Cleveland. And I think this is probably what's going to happen this next kind of 4 years in the next election cycle, is that Americans will decide that this political system as is isn't working for them. The two parties don't represent them. And therefore, there has to be a seismic shift. And that'll only come from the people. It's not a top down, but it'll be a bottom up.
Scott Jennings, Republican strategist who worked for George W. Bush's administration. Hank Sheinkopf, a political consultant who was an advisor to Bill Clinton. And Nadia Brown, political scientist at Georgetown University. Thank you all for joining and happy holidays.
Thank you.
Thank you.